Okay, so as we reach the equator of the course, we're going to start walking outside of the realms of Puritanism, and we're going to enter the depths of fiction. Before getting to fiction, we're going to have this class, which is very significant and very relevant for the historical moment that we're living. The autobiography of Benjamin Franklin was published towards the end of his life. I think the year is 1791. And that means that we've traversed around 180 years of history in only 6 units. What does that mean? That we've covered a lot of ground from a historical perspective, but we've been revolving around the same idea. We've been revolving around ideas that are highly connected to religion. These first 100 years of religion, we could say that it was a slight diminishing, great awakening, and then a tremendous fall towards oblivion for Puritanism. This means that from the year that we start to read works that are connected to Puritanism until we reach this moment that is a point of no return, more adequately, we could talk about 1777 as a moment when America stops being a colony and starts being a country. We can see that there is a rise of something different. There's going to be a rise of other types of writing. So we would say that, I'm going to use another word instead of secular. Okay. We would say that the importance of non-religious forms of expression are going to be much more relevant. Does that mean that religion disappears as such in America? No, it doesn't mean that religion disappears as such. But religion stops being dominant in terms of literature. We'll see a couple of instances where we see that there are authors that have faith in God, and they speak with a religious tone, or from a point of religiousness, the personal religiousness. But we're going to see how the separation is enormous. In the case of Benjamin Franklin, we're going to see a substitution of religion or morals and pragmatism. So in the case of Benjamin Franklin, we're going to see an example of what type of writing is proposed as a substitution of religious writing. In the case of Benjamin Franklin, he believes in a more spiritual, individual way of observing the world, following moral rules and a moral conduct, which was more in his writing than in his acts, and abiding to that sentiment that has to do more being practical, being pragmatic, and having a growing sense of nationalism. What we're starting to see here, undoubtedly, is the growth of an American feeling, of American identity. We'll see how that American identity is built over certain pillars that conform the American dream. And we're going to see how this age of reason, that we can also call... I ran out of word. Age of reason is imbued, but there's a transference of values. Because basically what we're seeing is that some of the values that belong to Puritanism, in the case of Benjamin Franklin, you can see a very distinct didactic purpose that could seem as if it were replicated from the Puritans, but that doesn't have to be the only driving force. In some cases, it's going to be the ideals of community, the ideals of being chosen people, and the ideals of being in a special place in the world, the chosen land. All of those seeds are going to be part not of Puritanism anymore, but of something bigger, something underlying, something that is growing in the underground, the American dream. So the underlying element is that of the American dream. Okay? Let me read from the beginning of section 2 of chapter 2, from Puritanism to Postmodernism. And it talks about Benjamin Franklin and his early life and how he's an example of this new kind of Western culture citizen. In America, there is a new land. There is a new land that, for the first time, has removed the bonds of one person that represents everyone. In this, there is no longer one identity, one individual, one idea that everybody has to worship or follow their command. In the case of men, it would be a king, the royalty. There are normally people that according to tradition are set by divine providence to rule over the masses. In this case, America is the first part of a civilized world that is free of a king, of a single ruler, and is independent enough to allow religious freedom without conditioning religious freedom to the entire society, without imposing religion. America is a place where religion is not imposed. Religion is accepted. So that gives something that men don't have in other parts of the world, liberty. There are other countries in the world where religion is not an option. It's a must. Places like Spain, places like England, where other forms of religion are persecuted, expelled from the country, taken to trial, burnt, all types of things. In America, and this is when I'm saying all of this, I don't want you to think that I'm being naive. Of course, this is the official message, and the reality is a different one. But in this new territory that is being born, the tone is absolutely different. The tone and the attitude is an attitude of liberty. It's an attitude of freedom, and it's an attitude of a new tomorrow, what are you talking about Edwards or Franklin? Oh, we're talking about Benjamin Franklin this week. You do know that, don't you? in the chat. Last week we talked about Jonathan Edwards. You can watch that recording. Today we're going to be talking about Benjamin Franklin. Okay. So past this period, and let's state where Jonathan Edwards a point is. Jonathan Edwards is Jonathan Edwards' peak is here during the Great Awakening. What is going to be an emerging influence is going to be the coming of the revolution. The American Revolution represents the end of a tyrannic domination of a king, in theory, and the substitution of one single person that decides, that taxes, that governs, that provides justice, for a substitution of a collective governance. If you read the American Constitution, one of the oldest constitutions in the world, you will see that the beginning of the constitutions is "We the People," which is a substitute to "I the King." So the "I" leaves place to the "We." That's a theory. That's the nice theory, that it's going to be a land of liberty, a land of freedom. Next week and the week afterwards, we're going to see that it's also going to be the land of slavery and the land of social injustice. So it's going to have a very nice facade that is going to be incredibly inspiring for the entire world. But at the same time, it's going to have like some dead skeletons in the closet that it doesn't want to show. Some things to feel ashamed about. We're going to study that in other units. In this unit, we're going to study America and this initial sentiment of American liberty as a moment of opportunity. And that's what the American dream turns out to become. It turns out to become the land of opportunity instead of the land of the chosen. A very distinct group of people instead of the chosen people. It's going to be like a transformation of all the ideas. The manifest destiny is going to be an eternal a thirst of expansion towards the West now that they've become liberated of the governance of the English. We could talk for an entire course just about the American Revolution. You have Mundos Anglófonos to talk about history. So I'm not going to focus on history because that's not my job. I could focus on history for an entire year, but I'm not going to do that. I could focus on Benjamin Franklin for an entire year. I'm not going to do that. I have to condense everything in an hour and a half. Why is Franklin so fascinating? Franklin is so fascinating because he is an incredible person that is able to do an incredible amount of things. And he lives in a very long life. He's the only signer of the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Peace, the U.S. Constitution. He is the only founding father whose signature is present in all the important U.S. documents in history. He is not only that, he's a publisher, an incredible inventor. He is a philosopher, a thinker, an author, an editor. The amount of things that he provides to the world is so incredible that many of the inventions that he discovered are still in use nowadays. On top of this building, there's probably a lightning rod to prevent lightning from falling on the ground and attracting it to one single point on buildings. That's an invention of Benjamin Franklin. He was so interested in that invention that he didn't pursue the patent, and he gave that invention to the world. He's the inventor of the libraries, inventor of street lighting, inventor of the postal service in America, inventor of the Pony Express. He discovered the best way to navigate from Europe to America by sea, just observing the temperature of the waters on his trips back and forth. Ambassador of America to London, ambassador of America to France. What I want to explain is that his figure is incredibly big. And here we're going to condense only a very, very small fraction of the life and the works of Benjamin Franklin. But if you are to pursue studying American history in the future, I would say that one of the areas where you should focus is Benjamin Franklin, precisely. I'm going to sit down and try to catch my breath because it's really hard to talk all the time behind the face mask. I'm going to read from Puritanism to Postmodernism. And, oh my God, this is so hard with a face mask. On page 41, it says, of this new self-created American type, Franklin seems the supreme example. He was born in Boston. So what we're seeing is that Boston is going to become one of the important points of reference in this early American scenario. He, like Edwards, heard of the sermons of the Puritans. But after schooling and after meager schooling, he went to school for only 1 year. He spent 2 years in London learning about liberty and necessity and writing pamphlets. So from a very early period, you're going to see that Benjamin Franklin is going to embrace the idea of Puritanism. For him, Puritanism, for Franklin, is an inspiration rather than a religion to follow. So he heard sermons, but he wasn't very attracted to religion. He believed in a personal point of view of religion that linked him more to deism. Deism is the sworn enemy of Puritanism. And since he was in this middle ground, he really didn't care. If we can talk about his biography, I think I mentioned his different roles in life. He was a 10th son of a soap maker, and his father could only send one child to school every year. And you can imagine that studying 1 year out of every 10 was not the most profitable way of learning and receiving a proper education. So he was self-taught. How did this happen? If he was living in an impoverished family, his brothers were publishers. Two of his brothers were publishers. And he began an apprenticeship with one of his brothers, which did not treat him very well. His brother sometimes abused of him and was very violent with him. At the age of 12, he could. I don't know if you're familiar with the age. This is the age when Gutenberg's printing press is becoming available worldwide. The printing press is one of the big elements that changes the history of mankind. After the printing press is fully available, men are able to express their ideas. First of all, everybody has access to the Bible. The Bible is translated, the King James Bible. King James Bible is the most sold book in the world. Why? Because you didn't have to go every Sunday to church to hear the sermon that was pre-selected by the preacher to be told to you. You had access to the book. So for the time, that was like discovering fire, to be able to have a Bible of your own. Owning a book was extremely exclusive. Literacy was very, very rare in America. In America, it was even more rare than in Europe. Just think how hard it was to survive in America. It was only a matter of concern for the wealthiest parts of society to receive a proper education. So the normal thing was when you were born into the family of a soap maker to be illiterate. But not only was he literate, he was self-taught. He taught himself everything he knew, and he knew a lot. Just referring to the printing press, at the age of 12, he was able to produce an entire newspaper. He was able to set type, print, and sell pamphlets. Pamphlets are the antecedent of newspapers. He worked for Boston's first newspaper, the New England Courant. His family was confronted with one of the most important religious families of Massachusetts, the Mathers. So that made Benjamin Franklin's family be in an uncomfortable position in terms of the society. Franklin's importance comes from this point of view, that he is the first recognizable self-made man. The concept of self-made man has always been a matter of pride for Americans. Americans are very proud of this concept of, if you work hard enough, you can achieve anything in life. But in the case of Benjamin Franklin, it's even more important, because it means the cultural independence from the English. It means that the American no longer have to depend on the English, not for governance, not even for inspiration. What Benjamin Franklin and the people that followed Benjamin Franklin aimed to achieve was a cultural independence. So cultural independence becomes a priority. We're going to see how, within the framework of a Puritan upbringing, of a country that's been very, very Puritan for almost 150 years, the importance of the style, the importance of the way that the Puritans transferred information is not going to disappear. It's going to be used by the writers that come afterwards, sometimes as a way of producing a different type of writing. Like, for example, the pragmatic moral style of Benjamin Franklin. If you have to label Benjamin Franklin's style, pragmatic and moral is a great way of using two adjectives to define it. Later authors are going to come from Puritan families, but they're not going to be Puritan. What are they going to do? They're going to use the style of Puritanism to subvert it. They're going to use it against Puritanism. So it's going to be intentionally harmful for the principles of Puritanism. It's going to be sometimes a mockery of Puritanism. Sometimes it's going to be an abuse of structures that belong to Puritanism as a way of having some type of revenge or another way of seeing the world for a part of society that was as narrow-minded as the Puritans. We're going to see that at the beginning of the second semester. The Romantic authors are going to write sometimes in Puritan fashion, but against the Puritanism. Okay, so what we're starting to see is not only the decline of Puritanism, but very soon we're going to see how there's a surge of anti-Puritanism, of a sentiment of trying to erase everything that could resemble the old era, of trying to become American, of trying to become independent culturally. So, It's very common in writing to say that for an author to become independent, to have a style of their own, they have to kill their literary father. Well, in that sense, that is going to happen. But for the moment, we're not going to see that. We're going to see a period where, which is very normal, right after the decline of a movement. At the beginning of this decline, we're going to see how some of the things from Puritanism are reused, reshaped, repurposed. So there's a sort of recycling process of some of the tenets of Puritanism. Okay? I think I'm not going to read from here because it's going to make me... The text is really long. From the elements of his biography, I think that one of the things that we have to take into consideration is that Benjamin Franklin always aspired for America, for the territory that he lived in and that he loved, to be a space for greatness. At the beginning, he was not independentist. He was not even in favor of a war, not in favor of fighting against the English and becoming independent. So in the case of Benjamin Franklin, throughout his lifetime, you can see a transition from being very pro-British to becoming pro-independence or pro-revolution. At the beginning of the revolution, people weren't very sure that America could pull off a win, and it was very common for people that were participating in the war to think that the war would end in some type of truce, and America would go back to being a colony, or a set of colonies, a collection of colonies, because every colony declared war on England independently, just that they combined forces. That's very important to take into consideration. It is only after declaring independence that there starts to be a sentiment of union. There was no sentiment of union. There was no sentiment of Americanism. There was only a sentiment of Americanism provoked by a war that made them join or die. There's a very famous pamphlet that says "Join or Die" to the 13 colonies. You've probably seen it in Mundos Anglófonos. That the only chance that they stood of defeating a superpower, a military superpower, was joining all their forces under the command of one person, of George Washington, and receiving a lot of underground help from Spain and France. That's the part that nobody talks about. But going back to Benjamin Franklin, what was his role in the revolution? He was sent to France as an ambassador. What was his job? His job was to convince the French to send military aid. He was also one of the people that was in direct contact with the King of England, with George III. So Benjamin Franklin's role was the role of a diplomat superstar. Benjamin Franklin is the first American celebrity, the first person that is known worldwide. First of all, because of his role in the highest spheres, talking to kings, talking to the King of France, talking to the King of England, taking on really important missions in Europe, and also for his achievements in his own territory, for his invention. We all know about, we all know that he was very interested in electricity, and he's famous for a famous experiment with a kite and a key, and how he was electrocuted by the key, and he discovered the conductivity of electricity, which is an incredible achievement. But it's only one of the many hundreds of achievements that are all across his biography. So what role does Benjamin Franklin have exactly in a literature course in a year that has so many authors, 24 authors? His role is very important. He's the first figure that is going to start to shape what is American and what is not. What is American as a way of distinguishing it from the old Europe. This old versus new that we started to see as one of the tenets of the Age of Enlightenment is what is going to be so important about Benjamin Franklin. He's going to start to shape this new era. In this new era, It's not the time for the big empires of the past. The sun is setting for the big empires of the past, little by little, over the course of the 19th century. Countries some of them will still rise and gain importance in the international arena. But it's going to be a new period. It's going to be a modern period. And the American example is going to be an instigator of social revolution. Because of the American Revolution, curiously enough, one of America's biggest allies, France, suffers a French Revolution. And there is a set of revolutions that hit throughout the world that make the empires notice that the time of the big empires, the big expansionist empires, is coming to an end, very little by little. In this new era, new superpowers have to emerge. And one of these superpowers, first from a military point of view, and then from a cultural point of view, is going to be the American people. America is going to stop looking at England for everything, for permission, for authority, for inspiration. America is going to turn into a source of inspiration, not a place of imitation. America achieves cultural independence. Americans and British speak the same language, but they're no longer speaking the same type of reality. They're no longer describing the same type of reality. And that is because of the work of all the authors that we're going to talk about. We're going to spend two units talking about slavery and its grave importance in the founding of America and why slavery persisted despite the effort of independence. How can we match those ideas of enslaving somebody and championing freedom? How can we do that? Well, with a lot of hypocrisy in the first place, but in the second place, was it possible to think of an America without slavery? In the opinion of most of the founding fathers and most of the people in the early American history, it was just not possible. So the practicality that we see in Benjamin Franklin is also applied in a negative aspect. And we're going to see how slavery is just very practical. It's a very practical way of rising to power, of developing economic freedom. So it's a shortcut, and the shortcut has certainly grave consequences. Let's talk about the American Enlightenment for a moment. What does that American Enlightenment stand for? The period of American Enlightenment spans over a period of one century between 1714 and 1818. This is the American Enlightenment. And it has, in the middle, the moment of the Declaration of Independence. It is distinctly something that happens throughout the 13 American colonies. And there is a search of justice, liberty, and equality. Which is very funny, because at the same time as these three ideas are pushed as priorities for the American people, they're put in front of slavery. That is something that is happening, especially in the southern colonies. So, in the case of slavery and how well it combines with these elements, I can say that. For the southern colonies, they came to the conclusion that there was no way that they could be productive and competitive in a modern world without leaving all the workforce to the slaves. In the north, however, they had a different sentiment, and it was a more urban territory. Of course, there were slaves in the north, Let's not misunderstand it. But when there was a final union, slavery was forbidden in the North, and it was permitted in the South. And that created a division that we're going to see how later on, in the middle of the 19th century, is going to provoke a civil war. And we're going to see how that has a consequence in terms of literature. It also has a consequence. Of course it does. Benjamin Franklin is the center, the epitome of American Enlightenment. Benjamin Franklin embodies American Enlightenment. It started as an idea that was more philosophical and moral than practical in colleges, and it covers all the grounds of knowledge. If we think about religious leaders, we can say that American Enlightenment is also Jonathan Edwards. Of course it is. If we think about political thinkers, we can say that many of the founding fathers, John Adams, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, they're examples of political thinkers that believed in that American Enlightenment, that let's make this different, let's make this better. In the case of polymaths, sabios, we can think of Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson, also a very important figure in every arena, in Europe, in America. He was the third president of the United States. You could see how America had stopped becoming a territory of repetition and replication of whatever was going on in Europe and in England, and it became a territory of leaders, leading scientists. Benjamin Franklin's work on electricity is studied and understood and seen as revolutionary all around the world. Astrologers like William Smith discovers a transit of Venus. Jared Elliott makes breakthroughs in terms of agriculture and metallurgy. So we're taking Benjamin Franklin as an example of everything because he's a very convenient example. Let's talk about his literary work. Benjamin Franklin started his autobiography 20 years before publishing it in 1771, and it was only published after his death. One of Benjamin Franklin's last acts in life was signing the U.S. Constitution, and afterwards he passed away. His autobiography had been in the works forever. He wrote the autobiography as a way of serving the public. He uses in his works two pseudonyms. One of his pseudonyms is Richard Saunders. And the other one reminds us to the self-made men. The other one is Silence Do Good. So this reminds us to... Yes. Yes, he discovered very soon the influence of... He uses many pseudonyms throughout his life. He became famous, or his writing became famous, because he discovered very soon that writing a newspaper was very difficult, because one of the most attractive things at the time was receiving letters from the readers, but not sufficient readers wrote quality letters. So he started to make them up, and he would write them with pseudonyms, sometimes signing as a woman, sometimes signing as a man, just to make it interesting. Many of his initial works was writing as an old widow when he was a very young kid, and it became one of the most read articles of the newspaper. His brother discovered that he was doing that because he did it behind his brother's back. And he saw that it was working so good that he told him to continue doing it. His brother was very strict, but at the same time, he told him to continue doing that. He went from the printing business that he initially had to the journalism business. And from there, he started writing a work that would become the work of his lifetime. And I think that the autobiography, in that sense, is very, very similar to this work, The Almanac. The Almanac is probably Benjamin Franklin's most important work. It's called Poor Richard's Almanac, and it was famous for one reason, for the aphorism, los dichos. He is the inventor of an incredible amount of aphorisms that he invented as a way of this utilitarian pragmatism that we talked about. I think that's a key word that you have to walk away with. Utilitarian pragmatism. There's a question here. ¿Dónde se puede ver luego la clase grabada? I leave a link in the forum. That's Álvaro, I think, no? I leave a link in the forum. You can see the previous classes, the recordings are there. There's a class forum for Madrid, and you can watch it there. I don't remember the number of the classes. Class 45 this year, or I don't remember, because it changes every year. Since owning a book was so expensive for everyone, since owning books was so expensive, he thought of a method that would be very convenient for a group of people, and he convinced his friends to take his friends and the people that he knew to take their books to a dedicated space where each of them would donate their books to that space and each of them would take them out. So he invented the library from a practical point of view as a selfish way of having access to all those works that he simply could not afford when he was younger. So as you can see, he's very practical, very open-minded, thinking about the benefit for himself, but at the same time, the benefit for society. Oh, yes, and not only that, he's the inventor of a style of writing. Your classmate was asking whether the objective was first to benefit himself and then benefit the society. I would say that they went hand in hand. And the older he became, probably the more he shifted towards a collective convenience, more than his own personal convenience. I'm not saying it's negative. And of course, what you're saying is right, that he proved the method for himself, and then he made the method public for everybody to benefit. That scientific mind, yes. Well, the way he killed himself. Jonathan Edwards, last week we talked about the way he died, just trying to prove how useful science was to everybody. It is the age of experimentation. It is really when experimentation becomes important. So experimenting on oneself, and it can be a method, it can be something practical. What we're going to read today is exactly what your classmate is saying. It's this is my proven method of reaching virtue, and now I'm going to help you be as virtuous as I am. And that's a way that he would go around things. But it is true that during the initial period of his life, he was maybe more interested in his own self-interest, but there was always a second component of looking for the as time went by, he was a more experimented man. He had less personal aspirations, and he focused more on the collective good. So, I don't. Of course, it's not a derogatory thing to say that he looked for his own benefit. In American culture, looking for one's own benefit is very well seen. It's seen as a sign of a successful person. A trait of a successful person is someone who tries to be successful in life, who strives for that success. So that's why Benjamin Franklin is a perfect example of the self-made man, because he always aspired to doing something different, to doing something better, and to do it for himself and for the rest. So if we talk about these last classes, we've been saying, Captain John Smith, first book in English published in America. William Bradford, first providentialist book published in America. Anne Bradstreet, first female poetry, probably poetry, published in America. Mary Rowlandson, the first distinctly American genre, captivity narrative. If we skip Jonathan Edwards, well, his sermons are quite a thing, and they're quite original. I don't know if I could say first of something. But if we talk about Benjamin Franklin, we would probably say he's probably the inventor of self-help books, because the way he wrote was, this is what works for me. Why don't you try it out? And for example, in 1758, he wrote a book about how to become rich, which is one of the biggest subgenres of self-help books. Within the genre of self-help books, How to Become Rich is always a bestseller. His work from 1758, The Way to Wealth, is probably the first self-help book that is written exclusively for the purpose of helping people become rich. So his almanac, his entire almanac, which is a yearly installment, fortunately, people at Gwinnett are maybe not in their majority, fortunately or unfortunately, I really don't know if that's fortunate or unfortunately, not super young people that maybe lack some knowledge or some understanding. I don't know if you remember when you were young, really young, there used to be almanacs that came out every year that they had information about the moon cycles, interesting articles. It was like a general compendium of things you had to know in the world to carry on a happy life. That was Benjamin Franklin's individual biggest source of income during a huge period of his life. His Poor Richard's Almanac. It was so famous that it was a bestseller every single year. From that work, we have many of the aphorisms that have reached our age, and that, oh, this is out of the, I'm going to write it in a different slide. I'm definitely going to upload all the presentations by next week, so we don't have to suffer not having the slides on the screen, because it's a bit less comfortable to read like that. He wrote his almanac, and his almanac is full of aphorisms. And you can say, okay, yeah, I've read some aphorisms by Oscar Wilde. They're normally very funny. His idea was to make them, okay, sometimes they could have a twist of humor, but what they always had is a pinch of knowledge. That's the purpose of his quotes, of his aphorisms. Let me give you some, and you'll say, hey, I've heard that a million times in my life. I've heard it in Spanish. They're so important that they're universal. They're in every single language. Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn. That's an aphorism by Benjamin Franklin. By failing to prepare, you are preparing to fail. That's another aphorism by Benjamin Franklin. There never was a good war or a bad peace. Wine is constant proof that God loves us and loves to see us happy. As you can see, that combines that twist of humor and at the same time, something knowledgeable. Wine is good for the world. We are all born ignorant, but one must work hard to remain stupid. Another one, genius without education is like silver in the mine. A penny saved is a penny earned. So this idea of saving for the future that was so uncharacteristic of the 18th century is what makes him one in a kind. He's super advanced in terms of his chain of thought so advanced to his time. Never leave that till tomorrow, which you can do today. I think it's probably the saying that I've heard the most in my life. Nunca dejes para hoy lo que vas a hacer nunca dejes para mañana lo que vas a hacer hoy. I was going to say it the other way around. Benjamin Franklin. He that can have patience can have what he will. So patience as being one of the keys to that point of virtue. He that lives upon hope will die fasting. So hope doesn't feed you. You have to put hope, but then you have to put hard work. Okay, so that idea of all of these aphorisms work in line of reinforcing this utilitarian purpose of things, the practicality. The book calls it pragmatism. And it's all towards searching virtue. It's a search for virtue. It's trying to perfect through repetition, not perfecting out of the blue, perfecting through repetition. The 13 virtues that we're going to read in the autobiography, we're going to read a section from the autobiography. Let me find it for you. We're on page 97, and we're going to read the autobiography's second section, which is the most famous. There are 13 virtues in the autobiography that he thinks what he's giving us. This is a self-help book in essence. It's follow this and you're going to be a good person. And you're going to be happy. You're going to find real happiness through this. Not instant satisfaction, but true, profound happiness. So distinguishing between real happiness and just the mere satisfaction. So it's going to cover all of the elements of our life, from order to frugality to sexual interaction. So it's going to break all of the boundaries that we've established in this ultra-Puritan, highly religious world. Suddenly it's going to be okay to talk about just about anything within a framework of 18th century America. But just about everything. We're going to talk about chastity today. Professor Gibeck says on page 97, as an introduction to the autobiography, we're going to read an extract from the autobiography's second and most famous section, in which the 78-year-old autobiographer looks back at his youthful years and describes his plan for self-improvement through the practice of virtue. Franklin had internalized a Puritan habit of introspection or moral self-scrutiny, but he aimed at making good citizens rather than good Presbyterians. He was not interested in making good churchgoers. He was interested in making good people. That's very important. Churches were not telling their parishioners to be good people. They were telling them to be worthy of God, not pious, not loving, not caring for the rest of the world. They said, worry about your church. Follow these strict rules of the church. But he went beyond. He said, why don't you focus more on being good people, a good person, rather than a good Presbyterian? And that's a main shift in the idea. In order to test his scheme of self-improvement, he put his ideas into practice, using himself as an experimental subject, something that we already saw with Jonathan Edwards. This is very typical of the Age of Enlightenment and the Great Awakening. In the following passages, we will learn about how young Franklin attempted to modify his behavior with an eminently practical scheme, which did not pertain to Christian salvation, but to earthly success. We're modifying. We don't want salvation anymore. Salvation. Ooh. Salvation gives way to success. So what Benjamin Franklin is showing us is the key to success. No longer the key to salvation. Because he believes that everybody can achieve success. He doesn't think one of the best things about the caliber of the genius of Benjamin Franklin was that he was not vain. He did not have separated from the reality of the world. He wanted whatever was good for him to be able to be reusable for the rest. He wanted to rethink everything that he had been able to figure out and to decipher all those problems to the rest. So in the end, if you think about it, he does have the same type of attitude that a preacher would have, saying, I've read the Bible, I've understood the Word of God, I'm going to tell you the Word of God so you can understand it too. In that same sense, he's saying, I figured out life, I figured out how to be successful, I figured out how to be happy, I'm going to give you the formula. Because you can be happy too. Because you can be successful too. Because you can be wealthy too. Okay? So, as we were saying, sorry, Julio, I didn't see your message. Exactly. Page 97. We're going to read page 97 through page 100. Okay? That's what we're going to read in this final part of the class. So, what I want you to understand is that it's a departure from religion, but it's not a radical departure. It's like a slow transition from putting God at the center of everything, very, very in the line of enlightenment, to putting the human being in the center of everything. By empowering the human being, he's empowering his community, his city, his country. Okay, so the box continues to say, in our selection, we have retained the author's apostrophes for the missing examples. He says, conceived, wished, in order to preserve some of the 18th century flavor of the text, but we have modernized his spelling and his use of capital letters. In the 18th century, there was an abuse, a tremendous abuse of capital letters. But I think that you can see at the same time how language was in a constant process of rethinking and re-elaborating. And this style of speech can still be heard. There are certain territories that are isolated islands, very close to Canada or very close to America, where the inhabitants still speak with this 18th century style. If you're interested in that, there are fantastic videos on YouTube where you can listen to this 18th century this 18th century English. This is true English. So, he says, from the autobiography, it was about this time that I conceived the bold and arduous project of arriving at moral perfection. I wished I'd live without committing any fault at any time. I would conquer all that either natural inclination, custom, or company might lead me into. As I knew or thought I knew what was right and wrong, I did not see why I might not always do the one and avoid the other. But I soon found I had undertaken a task of more difficulty than I had imagined. While my care was employed in guarding against one's faults, I was surprised by another. Habit took the advantage of inattention. Inclination was sometimes too strong for reason. I concluded at length that the mere speculative conviction that it was our interest to be completely virtuous was not sufficient to prevent our slipping, and that the contrary habits must be broken and good ones acquired and established before we can have any dependence on a steady, uniform rectitude of conduct. For this purpose, I therefore contrive the following method. Before I continue reading, I want to call your attention on the idea that he says, prevent our slipping, which reminds us very much to Jonathan Edwards' sermon, where he says that we're on the verge of slipping into the abyss of hell. Right now, we have this enormous contrast between Jonathan Edwards that was warning us, as if it were the last warning we would ever receive, to escape from the pits of hell by changing everything in our life immediately and with enormous fear of God. Benjamin Franklin, however, was taking a much friendlier approach to the matter, saying that if we ever wanted to be virtuous, not that he was virtuous himself, but if we ever wanted to be virtuous, he had tried himself to perfect everything at the same time, and he had found it impossible. And therefore, he had had to look for a plan B. And that's what we're going to read. Not his plan A, which was to become virtuous all of a sudden, which he found impossible because he said he would slip into old attitudes. But that he had to develop a more elaborate method of perfecting himself little by little. And that way of breaking a big task into small things, probably the forefather of programming, breaking a big problem into smaller chunks, smaller problems. 13 problems in particular was his method to success. And it's what follows, line 15. In the various enumerations of moral virtues I had met in my reading, I found the catalog more or less numerous as different writers included more or fewer ideas under the same name. Temperance, for example, was by some confined to eating and drinking, while by others it was extended to mean the moderating every other pleasure, appetite, inclination, or passion, bodily or mental, even to our avarice or an ambition. I proposed to myself, for the sake of clearness, to use rather more names with fewer ideas annexed to each than a few names with more ideas. I included after 13 names of virtues all that at that time occurred to me as necessary or desirable, and annexed to each a short precept which fully expressed the extent to give to its meaning. These names of virtues with their precepts were, and take into consideration that he's putting everything from a positive perspective. If you think about okay, there's a question again by Alvaro. Alvaro, I think I talked about this before. In the class forum, in the virtual course, if you're accessing through Academos, you can find a link that says Foro de la Asignatura. There's a specific forum for this class, for the people that come to this class in Madrid. Within that link, you can find the way of accessing the forum, the recorded classes that we've had so far. So far, there are 5 recorded classes. This is the 6th. It's half of the first semester. You can find each of them there. If you also go to Inteca and you search for the name of the author, I always name the recording with the name of the author. You can also find it through Inteca because they're under my name. So you can find them both ways. You can also search for my name and search for any recordings that I have. All of the classes are going to appear there. Without further ado, what I was saying, what's the difference in focus between Benjamin Franklin and religion in general? Religion was focused on everything that people did wrong. It was focused on sin, and more particularly on mortal sin. Some of the sins were deadly. If you committed any of the 7 deadly sins, you were going straight to hell. No way you were getting out of there. But in Benjamin Franklin's view, everything is focused from the positive point of view. Conquer the day. Aspire to this small change in your life. Very American. It's a very American attitude of try this small conquest and then go for the next and then go for the next. Don't try to solve your life overnight. Try to little by little perfect yourself. So the 13 names of the virtues with their precepts are temperance, eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation. Silence, speak not but what may benefit others or yourself. Avoid trifling conversation. 3, order. Let all your things have their place. Let each part of your business have its time. Resolution. Resolve to perform what you ought. Perform without fail what you resolve. 5, frugality. Make no expense but to do good to others or yourself. Waste nothing. That i.e. Means this means, this is, okay? It's from Latin. I don't remember exactly what IE means. I remember that EG means exempla gratia, that means for example. But in this case, IE means this is. It's like a further explanation. Waste nothing. Industry, lose no time. Be always employed in something useful. Cut off all unnecessary actions. Sincerity, use no hurtful deceit. Think innocently and justly, and if you speak, speak accordingly. Justice, wrong none by doing injuries or omitting the benefits that are your duty. Moderation, avoid extremes. Forbear resenting injuries so much as you think they deserve. Cleanliness, tolerate no uncleanness in the body, clothes, or habitation. Tranquility, be not disturbed at trifles or at accidents common or unavoidable. Chastity, rarely use venery, that's sexual intercourse, but for health or offspring. For health, it's really interesting that not only for offspring, but to remain healthy. Benjamin Franklin's darker side of his biography is that he was an incredible womanizer and he had a heck of a life here in Europe, and he was really, really someone very well known in the days and in the nights of Paris and Versailles. That's probably what he's referring to when he talks about health. He was separated from his wife. His wife is still living in I don't remember if it was Boston or Philadelphia, for an incredible period of time, like 20 or 30 years. And because he was on duty here in Europe, and he went back only to see her die. It was like he went back when she was at the end of her life. So it's a very sad thing. He loved his wife very much, but from the point of view of how he loved a wife at the distance over so many years. They had very frequent, very frequent messaging back and forth in terms of letters. But he was not the most exemplary of husbands. By the way, one of the things that are dark parts, dark tints of his biography is that his son, took sides with the British, and he became estranged with his son for the rest of his life. So it is a contradiction in itself that he was probably the most successful man of his time. He was the inventor of self-help books, of how to be happy, something which he was probably unable to apply to himself, because estranging oneself from one's older son is probably one of the biggest tragedies one can have during their lifetime. He became estranged for the rest of his life of his older son, which is a sad thing in any context. Going back to chastity, Rarely use venery, but for health or offspring. Never to dullness, that means to the extreme, weakness, or the injury, I love this part, of your own or another's peace or reputation. Okay? Humility, this is probably the best. Imitate Jesus and Socrates. My intention being to acquire the habitude of all these virtues, I judged it would be well not to distract my attention by attempting the whole at once, but to fix it on one of them at a time. And when I should be master of that, then to proceed to another. And so on, till I should have gone through the 13. And as the previous acquisition of some might facilitate the acquisition of certain others, I arrange them with that view as they stand above. Temperance first, as it tends to procure the coolness and clearness of head, which is necessary where constant vigilance was to be kept, and guard maintained against the unremitting attraction of ancient habits and the force of perpetual temptations. This being acquired and established, silence would be more easy, and my desire being to gain knowledge at the same time that I improved in virtue and desire, and considering that in conversation it was obtained rather by the use of the ears than of the tongue, and therefore wishing to break a habit I was getting into of prattling, cunning, and joking, which only made me acceptable to trifling company, I gave silence a second place. So as you can see, his system is set a weekly objective, try to conquer that one, and without tampering the first one, try with the second. If you conquer the second, go to the third. If you conquer the third, go to the fourth. All the time trying to maintain all of those above. This and the next order I expected would allow me more time for attending to my project and my studies. Resolution, once become habitual, would keep me firm in my endeavors to obtain all the subsequent virtues. Frugality and industry, freeing me from my remaining debts and producing affluence and independence, would make more easy the practice of sincerity and justice, etc., etc. Conceiving then that agreeably to the advice of Pythagoras in his golden verses, daily examination would be necessary, I contrived the following method for concluding that examination. As you can see, he's making specific and very intentional references to classics. And this is very typical of the period. In the Age of Enlightenment, there is an attempt to recover the initial sources of knowledge of humanity. So that's why there's a reference to Pythagoras, Greek mathematician, Socrates, Greek philosopher, Jesus, one of the most important, if not the most important, religious figure of the of Western society. Well, of Western society for sure, but of humankind. Okay, so take into consideration how very intentionally he uses direct references to philosophers, worshipped individuals, and mathematicians. I made a little book in which I allotted a page for each of the virtues. I ruled each page with red ink, so as to have 7 columns, one for each day of the week. Marking each column with a letter for the day, I crossed these columns with 13 red lines, marking the beginning of each line with the first letter of one of the virtues, on which line and in its proper column I might mark by a little black spot every fault I found upon examination to have been committed respecting that virtue upon that day. So at the end of every day, he reviewed his process. I determined to give a week's strict attention to each of the virtues successively. Thus, in the first week, my great guard was to avoid even the least offense against temperance, leaving the other virtues to their ordinary chance, only marking every evening the faults of the day. Thus, if in the first week I could keep my first line marked T clear of spots. I suppose the habit of that virtue, so much strengthened and its opposite weakened, that I might venture extending my attention to include the next. And for the following week, keep both lines clear of spots, proceeding thus to the last. I could go through a course complete in 13 weeks, and 4 courses in a year. And like him who, having a garden to weed, does not attempt to eradicate all the bad herbs at once, which would exceed his reach and his strength, but works on one of the beds at a time, and having accomplished the first, proceeds to a second. So I hoped, the encouraging pleasure of seeing on my pages the progress I made in virtue by clearing successively my lines of their spots, till in the end, by a number of courses, I should be happy in viewing a clean book after a 13 weeks daily examination. So I think that this work is self-explanatory enough to understand the important shift in the style that we're going to be seeing moving forward. We're going to see a radical shift in what type of things are interesting for the writers. And we're going to see how religion is going to lose its predominance. I have to go because they've already signaled the time. Thank you very much. Have a fantastic week. I'll see you next week here, okay? Have a great week. And keep working on your pecs. And if you have any questions regarding the pecs or anything else, let me know. Write me an email.